tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists, bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists, bound to lose.
Yes,
all you fascists, bound to lose. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kim Schepela, who is director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University and also a professor of sociology and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of the University's Center for Human Values. And she lived in Budapest from 1994 to 1998, doing research on the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at Central European University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kim Schepela.
Nice to be here.
And it looks as though the Hungarian government has defied the European Union and adopted legislation that a lot of people say will limit the power of the somewhat independent constitutional court in Hungary, as well as criminalize homelessness, etc. So what's going on with this government? I know the opposition boycotted the vote, but could you give us a description of the nature of this government? Because people are sort of talking about this is a sort of return to the sort of dark days of European fascism.
Well, I think that that's probably an exaggeration, but things are nonetheless very, very serious. The current government in Hungary was elected in a free and fair election in 2010. Hungary has a very unusual election law that gives parties that win their majorities, super majorities in the parliament. They had this law after 1989 because they were worried about lots and lots of little parties and not being able to form governments. Right now, however, in Hungary, you've got only a few parties. So when parties win, they tend to win really big. And the current party, namely Fidesz, won 52% of the vote in the election in 2010, but they got 68% of the seats in the parliament. And under the Hungarian constitution, you can change anything, including the constitution, with a single two-thirds vote. So this government has now undertaken to do exactly that, and they've passed a new constitution, more than 400 new laws, an eight-volume civil code, a new criminal code. Almost every major law has been rewritten. And then what they did today was to pass a 15-page amendment to the 45-page constitution, putting into the constitution a lot of things that the government had to back down from because Europe challenged their a lot of the things that they had done over the last couple of years. So Hungary was negotiating with the EU. It also had a number of defeats that it had suffered at the hands of its own constitutional court. And this amendment was basically a way of throwing out all of those compromises that it had to make and to just start over by essentially rewriting the constitution.
So Hungary is apparently Europe's most indebted nation, and to some extent, I suppose, the European Union has leverage over Hungary, but they did manage to float some bonds recently. So what kind of leverage can the European Union exert, since they're clearly expressing displeasure at what's happening in Hungary?
Yeah, well, you know, Hungary has actually revealed that the EU has no more power to enforce the values of the European treaty and the European constitution. The Commission has no more power to enforce that than it had to fix the euro crisis. So essentially, the EU doesn't have very much leverage over Hungary. So it's true that Hungary was actually playing with the idea of getting an IMF loan because it is a highly indebted country, because its revenues have been rather limited. Hungary was going to go in on a bargain with the IMF. When the IMF comes in and tries to make a loan of last resort to an EU member, though, the EU sits there at the table, and so does the European Central Bank. And so Hungary was going to be forced to make concessions to not just the IMF, but also to the EU and the ECB. So that was one place where Europe could have exercised some leverage. But the Hungarians found ways to use what are rather euphemistically called unconventional budget measures so that they didn't have to make those concessions. So, for example, one thing the government did was to more or less forcibly nationalize private pensions. They took everybody's private pensions and said, if you don't give us your private pensions, you will never get a public pension that you paid into all your life. People turned over their private pensions to the government, and the government used it to plug a budget hole. You know, just literally took the private pensions and wrote off some of the deficit. So they didn't need the IMF loan. And they've taxed a number of the multinationals with special taxes. They've engaged in a whole series of other activities. Actually, the New York Times had an article last week on how they tax salt and sugar, which the New York Times portrayed as some health measure, but which I think everybody in the EU sees as another desperate effort to raise money from someplace other than a body that will constrain them. You know, so the Hungarian government's been able to limp along, and what that means is that the EU doesn't really have much leverage. The only thing the EU can really do is to remove Hungary's voting rights in the EU, in all of the places where countries vote as countries, which is not in everything, but only in some areas. And that has been such an extreme sanction that so far, until now, the EU has not been willing to consider it. But two major newspapers in Europe came out in the last week and said now it's time for Europe to consider that ultimate sanction, and we'll see if that actually catches on.
Again, I'm speaking with Kim Scheppeler, who is the director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. And from 1994 to 1998, she lived in Budapest doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at Central European University. But the court itself apparently has been independent up until today, I take it. And I take it that this ruling party, Fidesz, is playing a kind of populist card, is it not, in terms of defying foreign utility companies, cutting the bills, which of course are popular with households. I know I mentioned earlier criticism about it being sort of reminiscent of 1930s fascism, and you said that was hyperbole. But how would you describe Orbán, the leader of this party, and what makes him tick? And why is this country heading in this direction?
Yeah, so you got sort of three different questions there. So one is on, you know, is this fascism again? And second is on what's happened to the Constitutional Court. And third is populism. So let me do the fascism and populism pieces first. So first, I mean, Viktor Orban is a very charismatic guy. I knew him personally when I lived there. I mean, it's a small country. He's very charismatic. He built his political party really around himself. It's never had any other leader. People in the party are loyal to Orban personally. It's rumored that he has signed resignation letters for all the MPs in the parliament and all of the ministers who owe their careers to him so that essentially he can fire them at any time. He runs a very tight party structure in which there are no factions and in which there is rumored to be no dissent. And what Orban and his inner circle want is what everybody in the party carries out. I mean, that's more or less, I mean, believe it or not, in a free country, more or less true. Orban himself, I doubt, is really a fascist sympathizer, shall we say. I mean, that said, his party has really played a dangerous game of having its close associates use, you know, coded and not-so-coded anti-Semitic language and appeals to populism. There's been a huge amount of anti-Roma agitation, which the government claims not to support, and yet
that's the gypsies, example, right? The gypsies.
With Roma gypsies, yes. And so, for example, last summer there was a little village in northwest Hungary that was descended upon by 1,500 armed paramilitaries. I mean, paramilitaries meaning kind of, you know, standing armies that work with, in this case, probably Jobbik, which is a fascist party that is also in the parliament, got 17% of the vote in the last election. These paramilitaries kind of descended on this Roma village, surrounded it, and basically was chanting slogans like, "You will die here," to the Roma who were encircled. For 2 days, no police showed up. Okay, so is this a government action or not? Well, not a government action. It's not the government literally out there doing it. But when the police fail to show up, then you realize you're in a different world because the police are being told not to show up. I mean, you know, so Hungary is now a place where these vigilante actions are occurring at an alarmingly increasing rate. and yet the police don't seem to be able to do anything about it. And so the government comes out with weak condemnations of these things, so weak that you feel that their heart isn't in it. And so this is why a lot of people believe that the government is not only populist, you know, basically taxing the multinationals and not taxing the population, for example, but also, you know, really encouraging something that looks like fascism. And it's certainly the case that there's a segment of the Hungarian population for whom these messages are extremely attractive. And it's not just Jobbik, which is the kind of neo-fascist party that's appealing to that segment and that sentiment. But it's also Fidesz itself, because Fidesz is simply not condemning these things, allowing them to happen with a kind of wink, wink, and nod, nod, making it ambiguous whether they're really involved with it or not. So, you know, if they were really doing these things out front, Europe would have screamed a long time ago. But because it's all sort of encoded and slightly hidden, it's made it ambiguous enough that I think the EU doesn't know what to do. So that's sort of the fascism populism thing. And it's quite dangerous, by the way, I should say. I mean, a lot of Roma are getting beat up on the streets. This is also true with, you know, some people who are visibly Jewish. The anti-Semitism and anti-Roma sentiment always present in Hungary is at a height that I've never seen it at before, and the government is really not tamping it down. So all of that is extremely, extremely serious. There's also a set of issues that have to do with the Constitutional Court, as you mentioned. So, you know, for American listeners, it's probably worth saying that a Constitutional Court is kind of like a Supreme Court minus all the stuff that Americans don't really pay attention to, which is to say it's a court that only rules on constitutional questions. And Hungary has an unusual form of government, which is that it's a unicameral parliamentary system. So that means there's only one house of the Congress, and it means the prime minister, who's the main executive, is elected by a majority vote of that single house of the parliament, so that the executive is always guaranteed to have a majority for his policies in the parliament. So then you might want to say, where's the checks and balances here? And the answer is, well, there's no upper house. There's a very weak president also elected by the same parliament. So the main check on power in this government since 1990 has been the Constitutional Court, because for the first 20-plus years of this government's existence after the end of communism, the Constitutional Court was reviewing virtually every major law that the parliament passed to assess whether it complied with the Constitution or not. And at least in the 1990s, when I was working at the court struck down about one-third of all the laws it reviewed. I mean, so it was very active, I mean, in ways that are almost incomprehensible in an American context. So everyone got used to the idea that the court was the primary check on this one executive, you know, parliamentary merger, you know, that the executive and the parliament always act together. So this was the check. So when Viktor Orban, the prime minister, and his Fidesz political party came to power in 2010, I think that really what they've wanted to do is to grab all the power for themselves. I don't think it's terribly ideological. Like I said, I don't think it's because he's motivated by intolerant sentiment or really fascism, although his party appeals to that. Instead, I think he's just wanted all the marbles. You know, he wants to grab all the power. And so in order to do that, what you have to do is disable the Constitutional Court. And that's what he's been trying to do. So as soon as he came into power, his party changed the rules for electing judges to the court. So now the votes of only their party are enough to elect a judge to the court. Then they packed the court. So they expanded the bench from 11 to 15 judges, put four of their own guys on it. So in the first 2 years, they had six judges appointed from among the 15 now on the bench. Then they got another judge. 2 weeks ago, they got another judge. And a month from now, they get another judge, which is to say, in 3 years in power, they will have named nine of the 15 judges. So in the first 2 years of this government's term, before they were able to get full control of the Constitutional Court, the court has actually, against all predictions, including mine, been able to mobilize all the judges who were on the bench before this government came to power. And that includes, by the way, a number of conservative judges that might otherwise sympathized with the Fidesz government. The Constitutional Court and Peter Pozsolai, who's the president and I should say also a co-author and somebody I've known for a long time, Peter Pozsolai has been able to mobilize all of the judges who were on the bench before this government came to power, to consistently hand the government one defeat after another on many of their pet plans and programs. And this constitutional amendment that passed the parliament today, that's presumably why we're talking and where this started, the constitutional amendment essentially takes back all of those cases. It overrules all those cases where the government lost. And moreover, it nullifies the entire first 20-plus years of the Constitutional Court's case law, right? So, like, imagine if a U.S. president was elected and said, every case of the Supreme Court before I took office is hereby nullified and doesn't exist anymore. You know, that's what's just happened in Hungary. And so what many of us worry about is that a lot of the rights protections that have been developed since the end of communism were actually in those court decisions that everybody relied on and got used to. And now with this passage of the amendment, they're simply gone, and nobody knows what that means. You know, does it mean we don't have protections? Does it mean there are different protections? There's just no law, or there was all this law. Just imagine if all the Supreme Court decisions in the U.S. were vaporized overnight, and that's what this amendment does.
Again, I'm speaking with Kim Schepeler, who is the director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. And from 1994 to 1998, she lived in Budapest doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at Central European University. Well, what you've just told us is quite alarming, Kim. And when you add the echoes of fascism with going after the gypsies, criminalizing homelessness, I guess that's a part of stigmatizing the other, isn't it? I mean, when you say that Orbán isn't a fascist or doesn't have a political program in that direction, even though he's apparently allowing even more radical groups to go out and terrorize people, to what end? Why is he grabbing all this power? And you just explained how he's just vaporized the quarter of a century of laws or something. They're extraordinary, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, well, you know, it's just kind of interesting. And I think that, you know, what we all need is a psychobiography of Viktor Orban, which we don't have. But actually, there are two very good biographies written in Hungarian, which go some way towards answering this. I mean, I think what most of us have seen is that, you know, Orban basically wants to govern Hungary. And he's not particularly willing to tolerate anyone else in that position. So he's just trying to nail down all the power. And in order to do that, he does what he needs to do. And so I think that a lot of these, you know, unsavory ideological appeals are what he sees as a means to an end, which is to, you know, stay in power. In fact, he gave a speech before he took office that said he wanted to stay in power for 20 years. So actually, if you hear a fair amount of noise here, I apologize. There's people running through. I'm going to try to get to a quieter location here, if you can just hold on.
Oh, no problem.
And so, yeah, so anyway, I think that that Viktor Orban is basically, you know, he wants to hold power. So then the question is, why does he want to hold power? Some people have said it's because what he gets from this is he makes himself and his inner circle very rich. It's true that that his party has been able to amass a really substantial fortune by having a whole series of companies that operate in conjunction with his party that have benefited a lot from EU contracts. And so some of it may just be personal wealth. Some of it, I think, is certainly political control. In any event, what he's doing is quite consistent with the idea that he doesn't want anyone else to have a chance to ever be elected to run Hungary, which raises a real question about, you know, if it's not possible for an opposition party to win, and, you know, there may still be a chance for an opposition party to win, and the windows haven't been totally closed yet, but they're trying. I mean, the government's now trying. To what extent is Hungary still a democratic state? This is something I know that the EU has been really trying to wrestle with as they see, you know, one law after another passed with the effect of basically locking in power for this political party. This political party has changed all the election laws, for example. So, for example, one thing that's in this 15-page constitutional amendment is a ban on political advertising in any venue other than the state-controlled media. during election campaigns. Okay, so if you want to advertise on private radio, or if you want to advertise on private television, the Constitution prevents you from doing so. And yet the public media are all controlled by this political party. You know, and in fact, this political party fired most of the opposition, people who are, you know, friendly to the opposition who work for public television. So is the opposition really going to be able to put its ads through a TV and radio, public radio and TV mechanism that is really completely controlled by the people they're trying to unseat? We haven't seen how that's going to happen yet, but that's what the Constitution includes. So it's a whole series of rules of that kind that make you really wonder, you know, whether an opposition can really win any other election in Hungary after this one. So,
well, Kim Scheppler, I really appreciate you joining us here, and you have given us an extremely clear picture, and an alarming one, and I thank you.
Well, I thank you for paying attention to Hungary. It's a small country on the edge of Europe, but it's extremely important, and it may blow Europe up.
Well, on that note, I thank you again, Kim Scheppler, who is director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. And from 1994 to 1998, she lived in Budapest doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at the Central European University. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how many trillions America's Fortune 500 companies are hiding in profits stashed offshore to avoid taxes.
Exciting me. Once on journey, someone said nine.